All right, it is time for us to get started this afternoon. We are in Daniel chapter 1, and we'll be trying to get through that chapter today. I'm going to try to move it roughly a chapter per week because they're all so nice and self-contained. I don't want to break them up too much. We'll kind of see how that goes as we go, I guess. If you didn't catch what all was going on a minute ago, there's no slides because the projector has died, so there won't be any slides at all today of any kind. So we'll have to, you know, use the song books and stuff. So no slides for the class or the lesson or singing, and we'll figure out the projector situation as we move forward. Let's begin with a prayer together. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you that you are a God who is indeed in control, that you rule the kingdoms of man as you rule the universe. And we ask that we would put our trust in you no matter how things may seem around us, to know that what you are doing is according to your wisdom and according to your plan. Help us as we face difficulty to continue to trust in you. And help us to realize and to remember that with you we will be victorious. In your Son we pray. Amen. All right. Well, this first chapter of Daniel really divides up pretty neatly into three basic parts. There's kind of an opening section that sets the stage for what's going to happen in verses 1 through 7 as they are carried off into this Babylonian captivity. Kind of the beginning of what's happening to them there. There's the middle section, verses 8 through 16, that talk about a specific issue that they face and their decision regarding it, and we'll talk a fair amount about that. And then finally, in verses 17 through 21, is their presentation before the king as they're kind of tested to see how they've fared in these early stages of their training and their education and all of those kinds of things. So it breaks up pretty neatly into those three sections. And each section is going to have the same phrase in it, not exactly verbatim, but very close, that opens each section and tells us what is really the theme of this chapter as much as anything. So let me start with that. Because I do think that's an important thing to recognize as we move forward. And this is very directly related to what we talked about last time in terms of what is the big picture theme of the book of Daniel. You remember we did all the chapter summaries and wound up with the way I put it, at least, and all the ways that you put it were variations of the same thing, is, in terms of the principle, it is the Most High rules in the kingdoms of man. And in terms of the practical outgrowth of that, it's in spite of present appearances, God is in control and he will win the victory. And notice what you find in verse 2. As they're taken into captivity, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God and so forth and so on. And then down in verse 9, and God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And then down in verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the head of every one of the paragraphs, every one of these subsections, is God gave, fill in the blank, whatever it is. So the main idea of this chapter, as much as anything else, is that God is in control. That God is the one who is governing the course of events, whether it is them being taken into captivity, whether it is the conversation and the back and forth between Daniel and those above him as it regards this question of food, or whether it's their entire education process and how they will stand before the king in that day. Everything is God working behind the scenes. That's what Daniel 1 is about. So with that in mind, that's important at the outset, because in these first few verses, what you have is the king of Israel being given into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, some vessels from the temple being given into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, and some of the royal family, some of the royal youths being given into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And if it didn't say God gave this, who would you say was in control of things? Nebuchadnezzar, right? He's the one who's come in. He's the one who's defeated the king. He's the one who's plundered the temple. He's the one who's carrying off captives. Nebuchadnezzar is in control. But right at the outset, what the text Daniel says is, no, God's sovereignty is what's going on here. The nation of Judah is falling because God willed this to happen. Just as was prophesied all the way back in the time of Assyria, when you've got people like Isaiah saying this very thing, or, you know, Hosea. I mean, Isaiah is as specific as anybody that Babylon's going to be the one that does it. But this has been talked about for a long time. Now, as to the taking of these vessels, so verse 2, with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God, and so forth and so on. That's significant because in the ancient world, I think we've talked about this on several occasions before, but just by way of reminder in case it's slipped your mind. In the ancient world, wars were not just about the armies of the nations, and they weren't just about the nations themselves, they were about the gods of the nations as well. What the people in the ancient world believed is that if my army beat your army, that means my God is stronger than your God is. And one of the ways your God could really assert his authority was to allow you to go in and plunder the temple of this other God. Because everybody knows you can't just walk into a temple and take stuff out of it. The gods will get you. But if your God is strong enough to go to their homeland, to go to their temple, and to take the stuff out of their temple and put it in your temple, then your God is really stronger than their God is. That's just how everybody thought back then, whether or not it makes sense to you today. And so, not only is Nebuchadnezzar winning this battle and defeating this king and taking these youths, but by taking all of this stuff from the temple back to the temple of his gods, in the ancient world, everybody would have said, this means that their God's a whole lot stronger. But again, what Daniel 1 is telling us is this happened because God wanted it to happen. Whatever everyone else way it may have been thinking in the world around them there, the text of Daniel 1 is designed to make us realize that's not the case. God is letting his temple be plundered. God is letting his anointed king be defeated. God is letting his people be carried off into captivity. And that speaks volumes about the humility of God when you stop and think about it as well. Because what does God's reputation look like among the nations as all of this happens? Again, knowing that this is how everyone thinks, God's name is being dragged through the mud as his nation is defeated and as his temple is plundered. People would have spoken very badly about the God of the Judeans at this point, and God lets it happen. Why? Because God said this is what was going to happen. And so God is true to his promise, even if it means that his reputation is harmed, because he has to deal with sin the way that he said he would deal with sin. And so so that's the key point to make out of that, of those first couple of verses. Now, in verse 3, the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace. So this is a pretty narrowed down list of people when you think about it. Who are they? Well, they're the king's family and the nobility, first of all. So that basically rules out everybody in the entire nation, except for a very, very select few to start with. But they're also youths without blemish of good appearance. So they got to look good, too, because they're going to be now representing the kingdom of Babylon. They want very attractive people. Narrows it down a little bit further. Skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to learn the language. So they've got to be intelligent. They've got to be poised sorts of people, who competent to stand in the king's palace. So politically elite, physically impressive, intellectually able, socially poised people. This is the absolute cream of the crop that they're bringing back to Babylon, where they are going to, in essence, try to reprogram them. And I'll talk about that here in just a second. There's a series of things that they're going through, which is designed, I think, to kind of, you know, reset them into thinking more like Babylonians would think. Now, why would they bring all these young people back to do all of this? Well, a variety of reasons. One of those is that you kind of have built-in hostages. You have the king's family, the king's, I don't know how many of his own children or nephews of the nobility, the people who advise the king and their children and nephews and grandchildren as well. How much do you think that's going to impact whether this king decides to rebel against you now? It may or may not, depending on that particular king and how, you know, moral or evil or whatever he is. But the idea that your children are over there directly under the thumb of this king is somewhat of motivation to kind of stay in line. Now, on top of that, as you try to reprogram these people, you can get their people thinking more like your people. You have a conduit to introduce your culture back to that homeland and so forth and so on. So what is this kind of reprogramming that I'm talking about? Well, let's talk about a few things here. Verse 4 is kind of where I left off there. To teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans, the king assigned them a daily portion of food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. And we will find that Daniel resolved not to eat this food, and we'll talk more about that here in just a moment. But there are three things that are explicit that are happening to them, and one that is maybe, maybe not. We'll talk about that last. First of all, notice they are given this new teaching. They're being trained in the literature and language of the Babylonians, and the bulk of that is going to be the mythology and religion of the Babylonians. Tale of Gilgamesh and those kinds of things that talk about the gods of the Babylonians. This is a way of taking the myths and the legends and the worldview of the Babylonians and replacing everything they'd been trained with up to that point as the system of wisdom and worldview. What is your basis for your wisdom and your worldview? It's not going to be that Yahweh stuff anymore. Now you're going to be thinking in terms of Babylonian thought. That's the key thing that's going on there. Secondly, they're given this new food, the food that the king ate. The wine that he drank. The exact significance of this is debated. Like I said, we'll come back and talk about this in more depth in a second. But at the very least, it signifies dependence on the king. Where do you get your food from? Well, what does the Bible say where you get your food from? Well, you get it from God. That's where you put your trust for your daily portion of what you need. What they're being told here is their source of food is King Nebuchadnezzar, and that's where you need to put your trust. And so, new teaching to replace the wisdom of the Jews, new food source to replace the God of the Jews. Third, they're given new names. And this is an interesting thing over the course of the book of Daniel and how that all plays out. But first of all, notice that these are all names that are either El names or Yah names at the end. So Daniel, Mishael, Hananiah, Azariah. El being the shortened form of Elohim, which means God. Yah being the shortened form of Yahweh. Down to Yah, of course, that's the name of God. So these four names are all names that are rooted in the God of the Jews. And they are given these other names, Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and it's hard to know exactly what's going on with those, but these are names that are apparently based on a variety of Babylonian deities, Marduk, Bel, Nebo, three of them. One is hard to know exactly what it's based on, but the fact that the other three seem to be pretty clearly based on Babylonian gods, the fourth one probably is too. Part of the reason why it's hard to know for sure is that none of these are spelled exactly like the name should be spelled to be based on this other deity. And why is that the case? One of the suggestions has been made, which I think there's probably some merit to it, is that the author of Daniel has intentionally misspelled those names to not give any credence whatsoever to these other gods. So it should be Abednego, servant of the god Nebo, and instead it's Abednego, and so they change the spelling. They're intentionally corrupting the spellings of these pagan god names. That might be what's going on. If that's not it, I don't know. Belteshazzar is not how it would be spelled. It'd be spelled Belshazzar, like, you know, Belshazzar. And so that's probably Daniel's given name as well, but it's corrupted. And again, we don't know the exact motives, but that's one of the suggestions. So, and again, what's going on? You're replacing the Hebrew God with the Babylonian gods in their names themselves. Now, this becomes an interesting thing because, one, it doesn't seem to be consistent through the book of Daniel. We are more familiar with Daniel as Daniel, and we're more familiar with the other three as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so the common question is, why is Daniel still Daniel and the others take the Babylonian names? And the answer is, well, it's not quite that simple. The reason why we're more familiar with the other three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, is because that's what they're called in the chapter where they are featured, chapter 3, the fiery furnace. But notice in chapter 2, they are Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah again. And if you look carefully, I don't know that it's 100% this way, but the vast majority of the time, when it's in a Hebrew context, Daniel is Daniel, and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And when they're in the Babylonian court being spoken about by a Babylonian, in Daniel 5, when Daniel goes to Belshazzar to interpret the handwriting on the wall, he's not called Daniel. He's called by his Babylonian name, by the Babylonian. And in chapter 3, where Nebuchadnezzar is like, hey guys, why aren't you bowing down to this statue? It's Nebuchadnezzar calling them Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. When Daniel talks to him, he calls them Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in chapter 2. And so it seems to be, most of the time, what is the context, who's talking? If they're talking among themselves, or if it's just the narrator describing them amongst themselves, he uses the Hebrew names. When it's the Babylonian context, on the lips of the Babylonian, it's more likely to be the Babylonian name. Now again, that's not 100%, I don't believe, but that's most of the time, and that's my explanation of it. I'll leave that there. Now, so you've got three things that we've said already. They've given new names, they have this new teaching, they have this new source of food. The last one is tied in, and you have to read between the lines, and it may or may not be the case, and so I'm not going to push this one way or the other. But flip back to Isaiah for a second to give a little bit of context here. Isaiah chapter 39. This is where Hezekiah is king, and these envoys from Babylon have come in, and he's showing off the wealth of the temple, and God's not too pleased about what's going on here in this scene. And so in Daniel chapter 39, verse 5, Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried off to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And some of your own sons who shall come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." And then Hezekiah says, like, the most awful thing that anyone could say in response to this, which is, hey, this is great, at least it's not going to happen while I'm alive. And you scratch your head and you say, this is one of the best kings of God's people, and he has that attitude about this. So, anyway, the point is, some of your own descendants will be carried off to Babylon, and they'll be made eunuchs in the palace of the king. Well, we've got some of his descendants being carried off, and then notice in verse 7 back in Daniel chapter 1, who is Daniel talking to, or who is he under? The chief of the eunuchs gave them new names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Meshach, Mishael he called Meshach, Azariah he called Abednego, and then down in verse 9, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And so, this is a little bit debatable because the text never comes out and says they were made eunuchs, but you've got a prophecy that some of Hezekiah's descendants were going to be taken off and made eunuchs, and you've got these descendants of Hezekiah who've been taken off, and they are under the charge of the chief of eunuchs. You add to that the terminology that's used to describe them as of good appearance in verse 4. And this is not a clincher one way or the other, to be clear, but that they're described as being of good appearance. Everywhere else, that terminology shows up in the Old Testament, in Genesis and Samuel and in Esther. It is used to describe a female, not a male. And so that might be a subtle hint as to what has happened to them. We don't know enough from the text of Daniel, but it doesn't appear that any of them are married. And so, again, you can read between the lines and piece it together, and it can go either way. The word itself does not necessarily necessitate eunuch in a technical sense. It can be officer. This same word is used of Potiphar, and he was married, but his wife was also chasing after another man. So, I don't know. What is significant about that, one way or the other, I think, is that it doesn't impact Daniel and his friend's relationship with God. And that's significant because if you look in Leviticus 21 and Deuteronomy chapter 23, eunuchs are not allowed to approach the temple. They're completely cut off from worship of God in a very, very important sense. Yet even if this is something that happens to Daniel and his friends, it does not stop their faith. And maybe it's because he knows what Isaiah goes on to say as well about eunuchs rejoicing in this new kingdom that is going to come in Isaiah 54 and in Isaiah 56. Well, whatever the case is, the goal of Nebuchadnezzar here is to basically obliterate their identity and their heritage, whether it is political or ethnic or theological, whatever it might be, to reprogram them into something different than they were when they arrived. And what's shocking is they go along with basically all of it. Now you might say, what control do they have over it? Well, I mean, to some degree it's answered in the next section where they put their foot down and say, we're not going to do this. At what other point could they have done that? I don't know. But they basically seem to just go along with it until this one issue of we're not going to eat this food. And what is it about that that makes it different? Is there something about it that's different? Is it the only thing they feel like they can even have any hope? Again, we're not told all their motivations, but they seem to be going along with everything just fine until there is a point to say, no further we will go. And maybe there is something in that to realize that there are ways in which we can look like our culture that aren't necessarily bad, and there are ways in which we can look like our culture that are absolutely horrible, and there are some that are a bit more innocuous and ambiguous, and it may depend on who's around us and what they might think of things. That, you know, it's not necessarily a dark, clear line of you must never look like your culture at all. I mean, you don't see Daniel, you know, sitting in the corner ignoring Nebuchadnezzar until he calls him Daniel instead of Belteshazzar. You better stop calling me that or I'm not going to respond to you. I'm not going to respond to that name, you know. That's not what happens. You're called that, you go along with it. And so, you know, where that line is drawn is I think to some degree a question of individual wisdom and conscience when it is not something that is clearly morally wrong. All right, let me stop for a second. I've been talking too long. Thoughts, questions, comments about this first paragraph? David.
The terminology in verse 4, it vaguely reminds me of the terminology used to describe sacrifices. Is that intended? Like without physical defects, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. That as if they're being offered up as, you know, sacrificial lambs, so to speak, on the altar of Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know. That does, it, in English at least, it's similar. I don't know if it's identical in the Hebrew or not. I'd have to look into that. And if it is, what is the significance? That's one of those things you have to be careful about drawing parallels. There was a journal article written years ago now about what this author called parallelomania, which is just finding parallels everywhere and drawing all the lines. And that is a real problem. There are definitely legitimate parallels, and there are sometimes it's a coincidence and it just has happened. And so that kind of becomes the question as well. What is the significance? I certainly think you could say, you know, they are kind of being sacrificed in a sense. This is this first wave of the captivity. Remember, there are the three waves of captivity. This is the first one where a very small group was taken into captivity, and you could kind of see them as sort of being sacrificed in the name of preserving the nation a little bit longer. So there may be something there, yeah. Noah?
What I'm wondering is, with them taking these, you know, descendants of a royal line and making them eunuchs, is that a practice that, you know, because I know other countries took this practice on of, you know, hostages essentially so that there's no uprising later. But wouldn't it be more advantageous to have them, you know, able to have kids that you keep having leverage?
Or possibly. I mean, and again, we don't know exactly who all else was taken. And exactly how these four were related to the king either. And we don't know if this what happened to them happened to everybody. So again, just be careful with the actual data we have and how far we extrapolate from it. But you got a couple possibilities. One is you keep them having kids, you keep having hostages, you keep having influence. The other is that if you cut off the royal line altogether, then you get to put on the throne whoever you want to put on the throne. And they would do that anyway. But by controlling and ending their royal line, especially if it's like the Davidic dynasty. I mean, the Northern Kingdom, it didn't matter. They were changing dynasties every 3 years, it seemed. In the South, it was all the Davidic line. So if you put an end to that, that is a psychologically damaging sort of thing. So that may have been part of it there as well. But yeah, I don't know all the ins and outs of that. Colleen?
Because I work at a college and I see young people come through, and I know how much can change in those years. The concept of taking them away from everything that they knew and giving them whole new things then makes it incredible to me that these young men remain faithful to God.
Yeah. Well, it's incredible that they're faithful to God anyway. I mean, we think about, you know, if our kids go to this big university and they're taught all this evil stuff, can they keep their faith? These kids are coming out of a house where there was no faith to begin with. I mean, it's amazing that they had faith growing up in the king's palace. So there's that element, and from basically no strong religious background in the family, at least. Obviously, we don't know all the details, but certainly not in the royalty at large, not in their neighbors around them. They go from that to Babylonian captivity and being taught all these things, and yet they keep faith. It is a really remarkable thing. Andrew?
For my own kind of almost historic context, I guess. So Nebuchadnezzar's campaign in this area was relatively quick, wasn't it?
Yes. At this point, especially. I mean, it was even when he was doing more stuff later on, yeah, he was pretty quick everywhere he went.
Right. So they, and Judah hadn't been a very significant nation since like Hezekiah or so, I'd imagine. And so, but in order to keep the king's household sizable enough to keep sustaining this growing empire, mm-hmm. they're probably four out of very, very, very many, you'd imagine, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And again,
hypothetically.
We don't know all the details, and we don't know how many they wanted to take with them. They are probably not the only four that were taken. Beyond that, I don't even know how to estimate.
I'm not saying just from Judah. I'm saying like from all the
other places. From all the other places they would have pulled from as well. Yeah, they probably weren't. This probably wasn't the only nation that youths were taken from for this kind of reprogramming. That's right. Dan?
So one comment I have is kind of like a sidebar.
Yeah.
Kind of going back to the last, Colleen had asked about the Hebrew to Aramaic.
Yes.
Seems like they don't know. And I looked at some Jewish stuff. And
okay, yeah.
Either, they think Daniel was written in 164, actually, with the Hasmoneans or the
yeah.
Jewish scholars don't really like Daniel because he was too cozy with, you know, Nebuchadnezzar who destroyed the temple. And I think there was something else I forget.
Yeah. Thanks.
But Ezra and Nehemiah also were written in Hebrew and Aramaic.
Yeah, there is. Well, I have to think. I think it's primarily Ezra, but a lot of, I don't know about Jewish people. I know in the Jewish canon, Ezra and Nehemiah are a single book. So it's
Daniel isn't listed in the Hebrew Bible with prophets.
That's right. Yep, it's with the writings.
Yeah,
which is an interesting. And it's a very different. I mean, it's very different from the rest of the prophets. Daniel and Jonah are kind of odd ducks as far as that goes. So yeah, that, thank you. I'll not chase that further because I'm tempted to say more, but we're quickly running out of time. So so verses 8 through 16, we're all familiar with this, so I won't take the time to read all of it. I hope you've looked at it or kind of scanning through it now as we go. This is where Daniel and his friends say, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to eat this food. And there are a couple stages of a plan, and that's one of those things that's, it's easy to forget if you've not read it recently. The first time Daniel says, can we do this instead? He's basically told no, but he's told no in such a way that it doesn't end things altogether, and he finds someone else important to ask and kind of runs it by that second person. And Daniel's very cautious and very wise. He's very unobtrusive. He's not grandstanding in all of this. He's given favor with the chief of the eunuchs, but the chief of the eunuchs basically says no, but he doesn't punish him for asking say, you know, never speak of this again. Or you'll, you know, be executed. And so there is still opportunity for Daniel to ask further. There may have even been an indication of, hey, I can't do this, as he's, you know, pointing at the other guy, saying, that's who you need to talk to. And again, we just don't know all of those kinds of details. But the fact that it's a little bit of a process is something that's worth noting and is easy to miss. And this second person, the steward, I mean, again, notice how Daniel says, asks this. I'll take a step back here. Daniel says, verse 8, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Can I not eat this food? Is maybe a simple way of summing that up. And the chief of the eunuchs has favor for Daniel, but basically says, hey, you're putting my head on the line if I allow this to happen. I can't do that. And so then Daniel goes to the steward of the chief of the eunuchs. And notice this time he has a modified approach. He says, let's test something out for just 10 days. Let us be given vegetables and water to eat and drink, and then judge how we look after those 10 days. And then we'll go with whatever your judgment is. So he goes to a different person, probably the person who's directly in charge of their food, who is kind of directly over them, more than the chief of the eunuchs, who'd be the next level up, and says, we'll do this on a limited run, we'll test it out, and if it doesn't work, then, you know, whatever, we'll just go with whatever has to happen. But there is confidence in Daniel that in order to not defile himself, he can do this and this will work, and this will be his way of avoiding this food. And the steward says, okay, we'll let this happen as a, you know, 10-day test run. Now, a couple things here before we talk about the motivation. First of all, notice that it begins with Daniel's resolution that he's not going to defile himself. And just on a practical note, this is just one of those classic verses that reminds us that purity doesn't happen without purpose. You don't stumble into purity. You don't just accidentally wind up doing the right things. It's when you decide you're going to do it and you set your mind to it and you focus on it, you resolve yourself to do it. That's when you make the good decisions. And I won't chase that too far because it's pretty obvious where you can go with that. But that is, I think, a key point of this on a practical level as we think about it. Secondly, as to what they're eating, does anyone have something different from vegetables down in verse 12? Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Is it vegetables all the way around? Yeah. Okay. The word there is a word that comes from the root, which the Hebrew word seed comes from as well. And so basically every Hebrew scholar that I've read says that vegetables is too narrow of a translation of this word, that it would really refer to any produce that is grown from seed. And that includes not just vegetables, but it would include fruit and grain as well, and presumably anything that could be made from that. This might be, as far as it goes, if we want to narrow it, what Daniel might be saying is give us bread and water. As just the basic essentials of life. You know, what is there, what is more basic than grain and water? It's hard to find much more basic than that. And who is the source of grain and water? Well, that's where Daniel's putting his faith as well. So, again, whatever exactly it is, it's hard to know. But what is significant about this is that, notice what they are tested to find in verse 15. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. Remember, different beauty standards in the ancient world. If you're really, really, really thin, it means you're poor. And so great thinness was not prized in the ancient world. They want a little bit more meat on your bones. Think about the book of Esther. They bring in all these young women. They feed them for a year before the king ever sees them. Because thin is poor, that's not attractive in the ancient world. And so they're trying to get more plump in this context. They're trying to be fatter in flesh to look, you know, healthy and robust and all of those kinds of things. And so you're going to eat nothing but, you know, water and vegetables for 10 days. How's that going to work out for getting fatter? Well, that's diet food, right? So the meal that Daniel has asked for, whatever the specifics of it may be, it's the exact opposite of what the purpose of their eating is. And so again, it's another way of seeing who's really in control of all of this to bless them in this way. Also, for what it's worth, Daniel is that guy that ruins it for everybody. The rest of them are being given this food from the king's table. They're eating like they've never eaten in their lives. You know, these Syrians and Edomites and Moabites, man, they are feasting like they've never feasted. And then Daniel comes along with this idea of water and vegetables, and it's great for them. And so now everyone else has to eat that too. So if you're an Edomite, captive, you're going to be pretty angry at Daniel as far as that goes. Or, I don't know, maybe they liked it. All right, the question, though, is what is the motivation? Why do they not want to eat this food? Well, my entire life I was told Jewish dietary laws, right? You've probably heard that explanation as well, right? All right, show me the verse in Leviticus that says they can only drink water and eat grain. This is way too narrow for just Jewish dietary laws. Is that a part of it, maybe? Maybe, I guess. But there is nothing in the old law that matches what Daniel asks for specifically. And so some have suggested, well, maybe they were under a Nazirite vow. And I say, okay, well, maybe they were. But as long as we're just making up stuff out of thin air to say maybe this is the case, you know, where you draw the line on that? Sure, that's possible, but there's nothing in the text to indicate that's what is going on. It has also been suggested they're trying to avoid commitment to a relationship, because to eat a meal with someone in the ancient world signified much more than it does now. Now you very often eat a meal with someone just because it's convenient. You know, you're at work, they're at work, you say, hey, let's go down to the lunchroom together, and you sit there across the table with one another, and you both eat for 30 minutes and go back to the office, and maybe you talk some and maybe you don't, but there's not a whole lot of meaning to it. In the ancient world, meals were very often of covenant kind of significance. It's a commitment to a relationship to eat the food from the king's table. And it is, you know, turning down that and saying, you know, I'm not going to do that sort of thing. The problem with that is, okay, where are these vegetables and water coming from then? Well, those are still coming from the king. Whatever they get is going to be coming from the king. So they're still partaking of the king's food. So if they're trying to draw a line of table fellowship, it's really hard to draw that line when the source of whatever food you get is going to be the king. And so that becomes a problem. Some have suggested that it was meat sacrificed to idols. Okay, well, maybe it was, but that's a non-issue. That's a New Testament topic. That's taking something we know from, you know, Corinthians and saying, I bet that's what Daniel was dealing with too. Yeah, I don't know that that would have even been in their thought process in Daniel's day the way, I mean, maybe because it was unclean, if it was sacrificed to an idol, but it was unclean because it was the food being prepared by pagans on a pagan kitchen and put on a pagan plate. It was ceremonial unclean no matter what happened to it. And so that's not the issue either. And I think ultimately, and I don't know for sure what their motivation is, but I think ultimately what they're doing is they're refusing the obvious diet to get the purpose accomplished and replacing it with a diet that is the exact opposite of what the purpose is, and trusting that they're going to succeed more than everyone else is anyway. And so when they succeed, who gets credit for the success? Is it the brilliant meal plan of Nebuchadnezzar, or is it the God who takes something that shouldn't work and makes it work anyway? And again, we're not told exactly what's going on, but my feeling, at least at this point, maybe I'll feel differently tomorrow, is that this is a way of indicating their trust in God. And they're showing in what small way they can that God is in control of their circumstances, regardless of what might seem to be the case otherwise. All right, I'll open that up for discussion in just a second. Let me go ahead and finish up a couple things on this chapter, and then we'll have some time to discuss whatever else. Verses 17 through 20, then, is their competence. They all grow in their wisdom and learning and skill. Daniel also, in a bit of foreshadowing here, we are told that he has understanding in all visions and dreams. And so, uniquely, he has this additional gift given to him, which is going to be vital for the rest of the entire book, just about. I mean, chapters 2, 4, 5, and 7 through 12 are all going to feature this element of Daniel's life. Also, amongst everyone that is brought in, they are rising in significance above all of them. Verse 19, Daniel, the king, spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. Like Andrew said, these weren't the only four people brought in. Probably not only the only nation of people that brought captives in, and of all of them, this group rise to the top, and they're put before the king in a place where they can have incredibly great influence that no one else can have. And it raises the question, and I'll just leave this for you to think about, that Dan brought up among Jewish scholars that don't like Daniel because he's so cozy with Nebuchadnezzar. Not just Jewish scholars today, how do you think the contemporaries of Daniel and his friends living back in Jerusalem would have thought of them as this is all unfolding if they're aware of what's going on? Not just that they happen to be there, but things that Daniel says, like in Daniel chapter 4, where he says, you know, he seems to genuinely care about Nebuchadnezzar. He says, let the dream be for someone else. Well, that could just be, you know, court language. Well, yeah, he says that, but then he goes on to say, king, please repent. Now's your chance. Change your life. And he is urging this king because he seems to genuinely care about the man. People back home, what do they think? Daniel, here's your chance. Take him out. Get rid of this guy. Get him off our backs. Would they be seen as traitors to their own people? And that's an interesting thing to think about, where you draw your lines of loyalty and all of those sorts of things. But what I want to end with here before I open this up for discussion, even though we're out of time, but that's all right. I'll tell the preacher to keep it short next hour. Verse 21, looks like one of those little throwaway verses, right? Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Okay, well, we've just suddenly jumped forward to the end of the Babylonian Empire. And this is one of those untils that, as the rest of the text indicates, it's not until and that's the end. It's until that point and continuing on. He is continuing in his position into the Persian Empire. And it's this little brief glimpse into the future. Daniel's lasting until the reign of Cyrus. And the significance of this historically, of course, is that this is the fall of Babylon and the rise of Persia. Well, what is the significance of that beyond just all of that? Well, what's significant is even as Daniel 1 is coming to its conclusion, mighty Babylon has fallen, but Daniel just keeps plugging along. Here, the nation that destroys God's people and the temple, it rises and it completely falls, but God's servant remains, continuing to serve God. Kingdoms rise, kingdoms fall, but God's people will go on. The servants of God out-endure the kingdoms of this world. And you get just that little glimpse here as this chapter comes to a close and Babylon comes to its end and Daniel just keeps right on going. All right, we'll take a couple minutes here for any last questions or comments about anything in the chapter, particularly the last sections that I ran through there really quickly. Andrew?
I guess for me it's also interesting. I hadn't really thought about it, but just what they're doing, Nebuchadnezzar's finding out their wisdom, and I assume it's not just trying to find out just a general knowledge test or anything. Mm-hmm. He's seeking their advice on things, and God is giving them this wisdom, and they are giving this wisdom to Nebuchadnezzar to run this country that is oppressing Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And so they are actively giving wisdom that is 10 times better than all the advisors Nebuchadnezzar could find how to better run this country that is the source of oppression for the people. And just another extreme reminder that this is exactly what God wants, is them to be in power right now.
Yep.
And he's continuing to make it even better for them.
Yeah. And Nebuchadnezzar's not in power just because he happened to be powerful. He was there as God's agent. And the fact that all of this is going on, like you said, just reinforces that idea that this is what God wants at this moment. And again, how important of an idea is that in the book of Daniel, that whatever it looked like, God is the one who is giving these people into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. God is the one who is giving Daniel favor so he doesn't get his head chopped off the moment that he says, I'm not going to eat this food. And God is the one who gives them their success to put them in this position where they can have this access and influence with the king. Anything else? Adam?
Just on the food defilement, I guess I had thought that they were thinking probably along the lines of, well, we know the law of God requires we only eat certain kinds of meat, but these pagans don't know those laws at all. And so if the pagans don't know those laws, maybe it's just easier for us to be safe when we
eat. Nothing at all, yeah. No, not necessarily. I mean, it would certainly fit the meat. It doesn't fit the water as well. That, you know, why are they restricting that as well? Would be still the open question. And, of course, we also don't know what all kinds of meats were being prepared. For all we know, there's like a, you know, spread, three different kinds of meat, pick whichever you want. And so I don't know that that was the case either. I'm not trying to say that it was. So it's really hard to know for sure what was going on because they don't specify their motivations. But what I will say is that it's not as simple as the law said they must only have these two kinds of items. If they're trying to be true to the law by being extra specific to make sure that they don't get anything bad, that's certainly a possibility. David?
Your explanation that wasn't wanting to be in fellowship with the idolaters reminds me of when Saul has that fellowship meal with the Witch of Endor, and other passages where it talks about having fellowship with darkness. That does seem like a more logical reason.
Yeah, that certainly is one of the possibilities, that it resonates in a different kind of way, especially if you've never thought about it before. All right, I'll stop. We're 5 minutes over. So we'll take a break here for a few moments, of course, and hopefully...